Good morning. An historic Surgeon General's report could be a game changer in effective treatment. Alan Johnson, head of the recovery center Hina Malka, considers the implications over the next decade. And two questions. What does it mean to have open government? And when is open government effective? A recent study takes a nuts and bolts approach to their answers. Contributing editor Neil Milner weaves the findings into the long view. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. It's one of the filmmaker's essential skills, and it's too little understood. Longtime editor Tom Galli prepares a workshop on the art of editing. And a Hawaii Island farmer was looking for an animal to raise on her five-acre property, so she made an unusual choice.
That's the conversation for this Wednesday, December 14th. Coming up next, the news.
Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vandercook. Good morning, Beth Ann.
Good morning.
We often hear about open government, but I'm not sure we know exactly what that would entail.
Well, a lot of people at the Brookings Institution would agree with you.
That's good to hear.
There's some research we're going to talk about this morning because you know that around elections and legislative sessions, we often hear criticism about the lack of open government. But what does open government actually mean and under what circumstances is it effective? A recent Brookings Institution study tried to find answers to those questions in practical terms. Contributing editor Neil Milner reviewed the research that comes with a scorecard, and it's different from other snapshots of the long view. Neil Milner joins us now, as he does most alternate Wednesdays. Good morning.
Good morning.
Okay, so this is different in its approach. It's different in the way that it tries to make sense of those terms, you know, open government and effectiveness. But how is this focused on the nuts and bolts aspect that makes it sort of, you know, easier or more approachable for people to understand?
Well, it really is a nuts and bolts. It's kind of a best practices look. What they did was to look at all kinds of research from all over the world, most of it small scale in villages, but also bigger stuff in the United States, to look at what it takes to have open government that's effective. Effective means it reduces corruption, it makes things more efficient, and so on. And what they did on the basis of all of this kind of stuff is to find what they say are the necessary things that are necessary for open government to exist and to work. And they find, for example, that these sound kind of commonsensical, but remember, we're dealing with human behavior, and they're not that commonsensical because they don't always work that way. One is that the policy is clear on who's supposed to be affected. The other is that there's relevant information to those people who are supposed to be affected. And the third is that this information is in accessible form.
It sounds like some of this is at the core of democracy, you know, of what people believe should be, and yet not necessarily part of the discussion even that we're having, you know, post-election.
No, I think that's right. This is really, they call it the core of democracy. That is, if you look at those things I just mentioned, which is just one part of the equation, it's basically about there being a clear and effective link between people and government. Now, we've talked on this show about a lot of research about voting behavior in the United States, and the relationship between people's beliefs and policy shows there isn't really that kind of clear thing at all. People are not always clear what they want. And also, there's a lot of research that shows there's an incredible differential in power about who gets what from Congress and who does not.
And in part based on which alliances are able to be formed, because I know we've had some other discussions that just because there's a group of people which wants something, they don't necessarily have the power to get it unless they're able to create an alliance with a group at a higher level on the food chain that might be able to get them that power.
That's right. That's a lot of the United States research is like that. One of the things that they show when they talk about other things that you need in order to bring about effective open government, one of the things that seems to make a difference is that if people have a forum in which they can talk about these stuff and kind of assess it. And the thing that they raise in there is exactly what you raised, although maybe on a smaller scale. There's a differential. If you have a forum, I don't care if it's a legislative hearing or anything else, there's likely to be a differential in terms of who's there and how effective and assertive the people are there. So just having a forum, just having the opportunity to, let's say, talk to your congressman or deal with some kind of village forum in India, doesn't mean that it's necessarily going to be effective. If it turns out it's there for co-optation or it's there because some people are much more able to have access in an effective way, it reduces the likelihood of effective open government.
So what else besides, you know, the clarity of intent and perhaps having alliances, does this particular Brookings Institution survey show makes for open government?
Well,
when
it's
people use that term, it doesn't necessarily
mean open government. No, it doesn't. What they find,
government.
Yeah, well, it doesn't, because they say, okay, you certainly need that link that we just talked about. But you also need what they say, looking at all this research, is one of the three following things, just one of them, and it seems to make it work. One of which is that the people that are effective have a chance to respond meaningfully, and that's what we just talked about. That is, that's one way. That if you have that, it makes open, plus those other three things I talk about, you have it. A second thing is that public officials support the policy. Now, that sounds easy, but it's not always the case. Lots of times, public officials who have to implement a policy are not all that interested. A third thing is that even if they don't necessarily support it or you don't have forum, if the people can work together to change the incentives of those who are supposed to implement the policy, that sounds pretty sterile. But if you think about that, that can be all kinds of forms of political protest, of anything else. If there isn't an effective forum available, and even if the public officials aren't all that interested in the policy, if you can change the incentives by some kind of protesting, it makes a difference.
So then if you put that into a broader context, Neil, I mean, if, say, for sake of argument, that were well understood, all those things, and that were happening, how does that affect the ability of government to be open and to govern effectively?
Well, that's the thing that this study is a little too nuts and boltsy about, because we've talked on this show before, pretty much based on Peter Shook's book about why government is often not effective, about how hard, inherently hard, governing is. And it's got little to do, it has somewhat, of course, to do with the capacity of the people, but the fact that oftentimes it's not clear what a policy's impact is going to be. Oftentimes people become committed to a policy and are not interested in seeing how it's working. And often government is asked to make some kind of policies that are extraordinarily difficult and that the private sector won't deal with. So that in all of this context, you have to remember how difficult it is to govern in the United States. So that's the thing, along with the fact that there isn't that clear link between the public officials and so on. So this study gives you some nice nuts and bolts stuff, but you also have to remember that in many ways, policy is up against odds in terms of effectiveness.
How do you consider this in terms of Hawaii and Hawaii's open government or lack?
Well, I think there's a lot of, if you look at what people complain about in regard to Hawaii, there's a couple of things that are important open government issues. First of all, transparency. It's very difficult to get certain kind of information through the open government laws that are supposed to exist. So it's not just about how good the website is. This place is notorious for not cooperating, let's say, with people who want to get stuff that they're entitled to. The other thing is that I think that there is a lot of limitations on the amount of assessment and evaluation that's done of policies. So I think that's another area that we tend to fall down in. I think a third one has to do with the incentives for government bureaucracies to carry out policies. You know, when we talk about government bureaucracy not working very well here, and when we have stories about the tax people and about the Department of Health not implementing policies, essentially that's I don't always say it in a polite way, but the polite way to say it is somehow the incentive system is lacking to get people to do what the policy is supposed to do.
Neil Milner, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
We'll talk in a couple weeks.
Sure.
Contributing editor Neil Milner joins us every other week for a look at the long view.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. It's 8:14. Coming up, the bridge between raw footage and the finished product. Explained. But first, your quiz.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we thought about a popular entertainer who used his influence to popularize Hawaii tourism and the sound of the ukulele. He was one of the most successful radio and television personalities of the 1950s, and he was a tireless promoter of all things Hawaii. He was named the Old Redhead, and he frequently played the ukulele on his programs. He also became a recurring guest on the nationwide radio program Hawaii Calls, which was broadcast live from the courtyard of the Moana Hotel in Waikiki. He even had a TV show that taught people how to play the ukulele. He was once a household name, and it's what we're looking for this morning. If you know, call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689, and the first one to get it right gets the prize.
Aloha, I'm Gwen Woltz from Wahine Media, and you're tuned to HPR2, Hawaii Public Radio. Learn more about what you hear on the show at facebook.com/HIConversation.
Filmmaking is a collaborative art. No one person can be responsible for every aspect of a movie, and some of its component tasks are designed not to call attention to themselves. Film editing can make or break a production, and Tom Galli, who's offering a workshop in the art of editing this evening, is in our studio this morning. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning.
Nobody comes out of a movie saying, boy, the editing was just great.
Not very many people do.
Unless they're a real serious film nerd, right?
Yes.
Why is that?
As you said, editing in one level is the art of not being noticed.
Yeah.
Think of a Futurama episode where Bender, the character Bender, meets God, and God tells him, if you do everything right, people aren't even sure you did anything at all.
That's a pretty good line, isn't it?
It is a good line. It's, you know, a completely different feel, but it applies to editing, too.
Yeah.
I mean, the idea is to pull the story out and leave people with that, not the technique, but, hey, that was a fantastic story about fill in the blank, a robot that met God, right?
Well, at the start of an editing process, you have all kinds of raw footage, mm-hmm. which might be in a 10 to 1 or greater ratio to what's going to end up on the screen, sometimes far greater ratio. So where do you even begin?
It's looking at it from the challenge of an independent filmmaker, which
right.
is, you know, the workshop I'll be doing, often you're involved in the whole thing from the beginning to the end, right? So you read the script. You were probably involved in the shooting. So you've got a good idea of what's there.
Yeah.
But even if you're not, it starts with immersing yourself in the footage and reading the script compulsively and then trying to look at these two. And, you know, after you've watched, like you said, a 10-to-1 shooting ratio is not uncommon. So for a 2-hour movie, you might be talking about 20 hours of raw footage.
Yeah.
You're going to watch that 20 hours of raw footage in its entirety, you know, multiple times, looking for whatever it is that makes you go, yes, that's the take. No, that's not the take.
And something I've found, Tom, in past edits is that if you seeing things over and over again can sometimes have the effect of make you hate everything, right? And then you sort of you lose your enthusiasm for what you once liked. Does that happen?
I tell my students when we move into the sections on editing, it takes a very specific brain defect to be an editor. I am so afflicted. I can watch the same clip 40 times in a row and not have it get old. And if it does get old, it tells me that it's got room to be improved on. There's something not quite right, and I still need to tweak something.
Because the trick is to keep your enthusiasm for this is great. I want this. This is the best take. And this is why it works.
Exactly.
So you have to sort of take that in each scene, you know, assemble your best takes, assemble all the shots that go along with maybe the best performance by an actor. And then you have to make sure that it lasts the right amount of time in the overall scheme.
And that's actually some of the hardest part. You'll get through the initial rough cut and, you know, you'll have sweated and bled and dreamt about this thing and you've got a product and you're happy that you've got a product and you watch it. And, okay, so it's 3.5 hours long, but it's beautiful.
Yeah.
And you've got to get it down to 90 minutes. It can't be done. It's not possible. I can't, you know. And that's actually where the hurt starts, right? Because you're taking these decisions that you've agonized over, these moments that you've labored over and sweated over and watched 60 times, trimming a frame off every single time. And you're going to throw that whole moment away. Got to go.
If your project is any good, chances are you're going to throw out shots and scenes, even scenes, that are very good.
Indeed.
You have to – because you'll – you know, hopefully if you're making an hour-and-a-half movie, you've got more than an hour-and-a-half of good stuff. But you can get attached to that and just be reluctant to part with something that becomes your pet.
Indeed. And it often pays to bring somebody in to make those calls for you, or if not those calls, to advise you. You know, to bring in somebody whose eye you trust and say, watch this, and then, you know, critique it for me. And I may listen to nothing that you say, but I may listen to some of it.
Yeah. Well, let's say you edit a scene and you're looking at it while you're editing the scene. You're thinking of the arc of that particular scene.
Mm-hmm.
Say you have an interaction between a couple of characters. The scene comes out at 4.5 minutes or whatever. Then you put it in the finished product and the movie screeches to a halt during that 4.5 minutes. It just drags. It's great in and of itself, but then you put it in context and suddenly it doesn't work.
Yep, that can totally happen. And you know, it's just one of those things you have to be willing to put up with. Again, this is part of the brain defect of the editor. You know, I have crafted this. I love this. I can't live without this. Okay, got to get rid of it. Bye.
Well, you know, at one extreme of filmmaking, you have Alfred Hitchcock, who said that the movie was essentially done by the time he completed the script, and that shooting the film was just executing, and the really editing was done in his head already. You know, he would fall asleep during takes and they'd wake him up and he'd say, yeah, it was a good take. Yeah, let's keep that, right? And so that's all sort of seen in his mind in advance. And yet his movies are very well edited. It was all kind of – but he knew in advance. And then you hear a lot of contemporary movies where they, you know, characters say, my part was completely thrown out in the editing process.
Yeah, the was it Suicide Squad? There was all that talk about how the Joker was almost removed.
Know,
all this fantastic footage and scenes that they shot, they pulled out because they decided it wasn't a movie about the Joker. It was a movie about the squad.
And that was a decision was made after everything had been shot and after everybody scripted, everybody thought they knew what it was going to be.
Well, that's the rumor. Yeah, that's what's flying around on the various interviews and whatnot.
Sure.
You know, on the one hand, I never know how much to credit that. But on the other hand, you're right. It would seem strange to me to start with a script that had all these beautiful scenes, that had been through an approval process, that had been vetted, that had been shot, and then go, yeah, you know what, 60% of this movie has to go away just because we don't think it should have been shot in the first place.
Yeah.
It seems bizarre to me that you could get that far into a process and then make such a major creative change to it. Not saying it can't happen, it just seems unwieldy.
You do hear about it a lot in today's Hollywood, perhaps more so than you did – well, certainly more so than you did when Hollywood was almost a factory and films were done in 3 weeks and then, you know, actors and directors were assigned, editors were assigned. They weren't necessarily a team coming in. It's a very different structure now, yeah?
Yeah, and again, I think in this could be an indictment of part of the Hollywood process. You know, when you're throwing budgets at films that are larger than the gross national products of small countries, I think there might be a certain level of complacency, sloppiness that gets introduced into it. If you see that sort of thing on the independent level, it's not that they got three quarters of the way through the film and suddenly had a completely different vision. It's that they failed to get it envisioned before they started shooting.
Right. So an awful lot depends on your advanced planning, no matter which way everything's going to go, right?
Yeah, there's no such thing as too much planning.
No, I think that's true to a lot of things.
Huh? Yeah.
Thanks very much for coming in.
My pleasure.
Tom Galley is a professor at Chaminade University, where he teaches radio and video production as part of the communication department. He'll conduct an Art of Editing workshop for Hawaii Filmmakers Collective members tonight from 6 to 8 p.m. at the HFC space on Wailea Avenue in Honolulu. And you can learn more about him on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Moving on now, fears of toxic soil at Marine Corps Base Hawaii have more families joining legal efforts to have those claims recognized. There are now 64 families suing over what they say has percolated into their lives for at least 10 years. Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair has the reality check. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
So we've had five lawsuits earlier in the year that were representing 44 families, and now we have another two lawsuits representing 20 more families. Why is all of this coming to light this year?
Well, they all are represented by the same attorneys, two attorneys here on Oahu. And there was a settlement with the initial litigant, the woman who initially complained a couple of years ago about these contaminated soil from pesticide there at Kaneohe Marine Base. That issue was settled out of court. And rather than have a class action lawsuit, what the courts are allowing is for other people to come forward who lived on base and feel that they may have been exposed to these toxic materials. We're talking about people that – military families specifically who lived at K-Bay between 2006 and 2014. And so if you will, there's a bit of a precedent to try and – you know, we don't know how the court ruled because what the settlement entailed because that was private. But there seems to be some impetus for others to follow suit in order to be compensated. They're looking for damages maybe not only for the rent that they paid over those years, but emotional distress, however you would measure that. But there's no dollar figure estimated.
Chad, what are they specifically alleging that Forest City Residential Management and its subsidiary Ohana Military Communities actually did in creating the toxic situation?
So these two companies leased, own, and manage the housing, the residential housing on base, and they're alleging that these defendants systematically failed to warn the families of pesticide contamination, that they knowingly exposed these families to unsafe conditions that could lead to higher rates of cancer and other adverse health risks. There have been reports of some asthma problems and even birth defects.
Was there any discussion of where this chemical came from? I know that they're talking about organochlorine as being one of them, but where did these things originate? How did they get into the soil in the first place?
Right. This particular carcinogen used for termite extermination, and in the process of leveling some houses to build new materials back in 06, they found out that the soil was contaminated, but whether they were told anybody seems to be at issue, whether that was the proper thing to do. There is some disagreement as to what is an appropriate safe level of exposure. As you know, we have termite extermination. Military bases in general on Oahu have been around for a very long time, and there's been a history of other problems with contaminated material, material that can expose people to all sorts of things. I'm thinking of asbestos, PCBs, for example. So these are the kind of things that the families are worried about. I mean, they feel like they were just – I mean, they're spending $2,000 or $3,000 a month at their base housing, but they were never properly informed about the conditions.
So where does this go now?
Well, we're going to have to see what happens. There's a number of disputes about which court should be in. Should it be in circuit court? Should it be in federal district court? Probably that'll be resolved by February. The defendants, by the way, attorneys for them, are trying to get rid of the attorneys for the plaintiffs. It's another long story. But we're looking at probably February. If things go forward, they could start issuing depositions and starting the discovery for a trial. Settlement is a possibility, too. But, boy, we're talking about a lot of people right now.
And a lot of people who are still living in K-Bay.
Yes, exactly.
All right. Thanks very much, Chad. We'll be watching this
Thanks.
One. And Thanks, we'll talk to you tomorrow. Okay. Every day, Chad Blair joins us from Civil Beat with a reality check.
Support for today's programming comes from the Maui Chamber Orchestra, presenting a holiday concert this Saturday and Sunday at the Eau Theater. Tickets at mauichamberorchestra.org or at the Eau Theater box office.
When we first talked about the Surgeon General's report, Facing Addiction in America, the response within the treatment community was almost jubilant. Historic was a word frequently used, and it was the first comprehensive report on addiction. Now, a month later, those who work with addicts and binge drinkers are also buoyed by yesterday's signing of the 21st Century Cures Act. Taken together, the approach could fuel a bipartisan movement to integrate and lengthen care and pay for it. Alan Johnson is president and CEO of Hina Mauka, a drug and alcohol treatment facility, and chair of the Hawaii Substance Abuse Coalition, and he joins us in our studio this morning. Good to see you.
Hey, thank you for having me today. Aloha.
One of the things that came out in this report was how many people were affected nationally. These, you know, almost 21 million people in the United States, and that it's costing us about $420 billion a year to be able to treat, because people cycle in and they cycle out and they cycle in, and that, you know, continues on and on and on. But it also gave a lot of voice to the idea that this is a neurological disease. This is not something that's just a moral failing or the, you know, inability to have willpower. How does that really begin to shift public thinking by seeing it come out in this report?
Well, that's a big part of making the changes for science to work, to redesign our systems, as the community will have to change their attitudes. We have a lot of negative attitudes and stigma about what addiction is and abuse, and that and it's huge numbers. I mean, what you talked about is 21 million is for addiction, but if you add abuse, it's 93 million. That's a huge number. And so for us to effectively treat that, which we can do today, how we look at how we act towards and what we think about those who have addiction has to change from the community level, which will really help systemic change. So these attitudes shifting, the community is a big part of it.
This seems almost the inverse of what had to happen with the 1964 Surgeon General's report, where people were wildly thinking that smoking was wonderful and terrific, and it took that Surgeon General's report to begin to shift the thinking in a different direction. As you look at this going forward, with so much that's yet unfunded, how do you begin to shift the attitudinal, you know, mindset, as opposed to saying, okay, now we have money and people are going to see it show up with how treatment is actually being delivered?
Well, for those of us, we have to tell our stories. We have to get out and really get in front of the community, and not just once, but repetitively, and all kinds of people doing it. And along the way, we'll shift in our systems too. And when we integrate with primary care, and your family doctor and your pediatrician starts talking about drug abuse or alcohol abuse, you know, every time you meet with them, that's going to help change the attitudes too. So it's a combined effort between the medical community and then reaching out to address the community. So, but we've seen things before. I mean, look at what happened with not just smoking, but look what happened with cancer and breast cancer, when there was huge stigma and no one was getting treatment for that in the 80s. There was a huge shift after the Surgeon General report. So we're thinking that's going to happen here now. The science has been there for 20 years. So now let's move forward with that science. So big changes could be happening.
It always seems to take a while for policy to catch up to the science. This seems to be another area in which we're seeing that happen again. But in terms of quantifiable outgrowths, as you look out over the arc of, say, you know, 10 years, a decade, where maybe this is going to have time to truly catch up and to be reflected in how we offer treatment and how well integrated that is. What do you see as some first steps in Hawaii?
Well, we've had that already with we received an $8 million grant to help change. And the governor's plan for health care reform includes specifically, you know, reforming how we look at substance abuse and how that's integrated. So how I would see that is, you know, just envision like how we would deal with diabetes, you know. So now you're going to go see your family doctor or your pediatrician, and you're going to say, and they're going to talk about how much is too much and what are you using. And over time, we're going to see people being more responding to that if the attitude in the community changed to see it a medical condition. And then as people respond to that, the doctor can give advice and say, well, you know, your brain is resilient. It can heal itself if you, you know, give it a period of break. And then if you're using too much, the doctors are going to say, well, we're going to do some screening and some motivational interviewing right in our doctor's office. And those are proven to be very effective. And then they're going to say, well, your use is more than that. It's more than mild. You're going to be moderate. We're going to refer to programs that address for moderate. There are no programs today for moderate, but we're going to build them. And then we'll say if you have more chronic conditions, well, then we're going to refer you to specialty care like Hinomoka and other agencies for doing outpatient and for doing residential. And that's for those who are not being treated right now, because right now, if you're not sick enough, we don't treat you. And so that's going to change. And then the other part of the population is those who are too sick. Well, we don't treat you either because we don't have the qualifications for it. And so now we're going to be looking at residential to say, oh, you have diabetes, you have heart condition. So now in residential, you need to have a doctor supervised, you need nurses, you're going to need medical assistance so that you can treat the whole person and not just one facet of their illness, and that people can recover then if you treat the whole person by giving them enough care for what they need when they need it. And that should be a huge change, and that will involve some payment reform and a redesigning of the systems. So that with community support could make a huge difference.
The macro vision that you just gave for a lot of people sounds like, well, that sounds like a very good thing, but who's going to pay for it? Where is this money going to come from, particularly if we see part of the ACA rolled back or if the funding doesn't really happen through the 21st Century Cures Act as a lot of people would, you know, suspect that it might?
Well, the, you know, 95% of the House and the Senate, you know, just approved, you know, $1 billion for 2 years. So it looks like both Republican and Democrats are really interested in putting money into this, and it has tremendous support by both. And look, you know, there's $442 billion a year we're spending on that. But when I was on the governor's task force, we had some actuarial people come in, and then we had some consultants from the mainland come in, and they said, if we were to design an integrated substance abuse and mental health system, that here in Hawaii, we could save $2 billion in 5 years. I mean, if you're talking about money, you have to do it because it's just too expensive not to do it. And that number is getting bigger if we don't do anything. But if you're talking about lives and suffering, that's a whole different thing. And when you come to changing the systems, I think the medical care providers will say, we see the need and we see the science is there. We cannot just sit idly by and do nothing.
Given the fact that we always talk about how short we are of doctors, does this play into it in any significant way in your mind, or if you redesign the system, maybe that's not going to be as crucial?
Yeah, I workforce is a problem, and so, you know, a major policy shift like this is just not going to happen overnight. And there are workforce issues. There's a huge shortage of primary care. You know, moving to that primary care manages more chronic illnesses. That's not what we've been doing in the United States. That has to shift. Finding doctors in our field alone, and where I'm at, there's a huge shortage of people who would do this kind of work. So capacity issues are going to be a systemic problem.
Which means we're going to have more conversations about this. But thank you, Alan, for coming in this morning.
Thank you for having me.
Alan Johnson is the president and CEO of Hinomoka, which has provided drug and alcohol treatment in Hawaii for 40 years. He's been affiliated with Hinomoka for half of that time and also chairs the Hawaii Substance Abuse Coalition. Now, tomorrow night on Town Square, we'll be taking this up in depth, and we hope you'll plan to call us. And meanwhile, you can see the link to the recent Surgeon General's report on our Facebook page, Hawaii Conversation.
helping people.
It made me feel good.
Taking care of people.
It's just something that you want to do.
I wanted to help.
Hi, everyone. This is Bob Wehrman. It's time for The Benevolent Mind, our quest to discover the spark that ignites giving. It may surprise you to learn that a medical treatment that's considered new by many has been around for more than 2,000 years. I'm referring to music therapy, which was first proposed by Pythagoras around 350 BCE. He discovered that playing certain combinations of pitches and tones to the ill eased their suffering. In modern times, music therapy has proven to offer relief to those suffering from Alzheimer's disease and other psychiatric disorders, and various forms of cancer, and even speech difficulties such as stuttering. In addition, it is shown to be a beneficial form of end-of-life therapy for both the dying and their families. For many years, music therapy was thought to be quackery and belonged in the group of the other woo-woo ideas such as tinfoil hats and insect therapy. But this attitude is highly inaccurate, for music therapy was found to be viable, a treatment that's helped many people. Recently, the Cook Foundation awarded a $20,000 gift to Hospice Hawaii's music therapy program. Our program is a production of Hawaii Public Radio and is sponsored by the Hawaii Community Foundation, believing for 100 years that philanthropy is all about you.
Mele Kalikimaka and happy holidays. This is Lisa Maruyama. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR, Hawaii Public Radio.
Tonight at 5, it's Bite Marks Cafe with Bert Lum and Ryan Ozawa. And Bert's on the line, and you'll be keeping an eye on pollutants, yeah?
Well, so we're going to be talking about groundwater. And normally we think of groundwater as our source for our fresh water. And, you know, there's all the artesian wells that provide us with fresh water. And we're going to be talking about the process by which the water gets absorbed into the land, right, fills up sort of these aquifers, and as these aquifers move from the land into the ocean, there's research going on right now to study what kinds of pollutants are in that fresh water as it exits, you know, exits out of those springs into the ocean. And so there's some interesting research that's being done, and they did a study area in Maui, and they found some very interesting pollutants and contaminants inside that fresh water as it exits into the ocean. So we'll talk about that. We'll also talk about, you know, the impact that those contaminants have on the marine life in that coastal region.
Those are some pretty troubling findings, Bert.
Well, you know, I mean, there's no lack of troubling findings all over the place if we look. But I think what it does is it helps inform some of the urban planners and some of the developers that are, and even agriculture, as an example, how they might contribute to this contamination and what they might do in the future.
Well, that's something to keep an eye on. Thanks a lot, Bert.
Sure thing. Thanks, Bert.
Bite Marks Cafe tonight at 5 p.m.
And now just a quick check of our Radio Flyers campaign. It lifted off on Monday, and we now have $6,405 to go to make our first matching gift of $10,000 from Dr. Tom Kosasa. Right now, your year-end donation could be doubled and multiplied again when we transfer 10 Hawaiian miles for every dollar to Kapi'olani Medical Center for Women and Children and Children's Family Fund. And all those miles will help to fly neighbor island families to and from Honolulu so that they can be with their hospitalized children. Now, you can donate online at hawaiipublicradio.org or call us at 808-955-8821 before the end of the day, and you'll be making a few more hearts lighter, including perhaps your own. Again, donations of any amount are welcome on the HPR website, or we can help you when you call us, call us at our Honolulu office at 955-8821, and many, many thanks.
In today's Backyard Quiz, the old redhead was one of the most popular American entertainers of the 1950s, heard daily on radio and weekly on CBS television. He was a frequent visitor to the islands who encouraged his audiences to travel to Hawaii and featured Hawaiian music and dance prominently on his show. Hilo-born Haleloke Kahaolopua, singer and Hila dancer, was a regular guest with whom he often accompanied on his ukulele. The ukulele was very much a part of his TV and his radio persona. For a brief period, he even had a television show teaching people how to play it. He's also credited with changing the perception of Hawaii as a visitor destination, presenting it as a vacation paradise for middle-class travelers and easing their concerns about air travel. Listeners to the Hawaii-based radio show Hawaii Calls knew him as a frequent guest host, ukulele always at the ready. And many people on the mainland today trace their knowledge of Hawaii to the TV show Arthur Godfrey Time. And we had a winner.
We do. Stanley Orr called us from Pearl City, knew the answer was Arthur Godfrey, and will be receiving the HPR prize. And now at 8:48, that's the end of today's quiz. But for a future one, if you have an idea, you can always send it in to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
If you were to drive by Jenny Brundage's farm in Ahualoa on Hawaii Island, you might think you'd taken a wrong turn and ended up in Peru. Jenny raises alpaca, a scaled-down relative of llamas with a much better disposition that have been domesticated for thousands of years. They're prized for their wool, and Jenny's on the phone to tell us what her life among the alpaca is like. Hi, Jenny.
Good morning, Chris.
What are these beasts like? What's their temperament like?
They're a very low-key, laid-back, easygoing kind of creature. They are very quiet and peaceful guys.
That's kind of nice for you, isn't it?
It's nice for me. They're my size. They look me in the eye. And so for me as a woman-owned business, it's kind of perfect. I'm not a cowgirl. I'm not wanting to be wrangling animals as I'm approaching retirement, and for me, they're a really good fit.
So they kind of wrangle themselves?
Yeah, they literally come when called.
No, I could see a lot of advantages to that. Yeah. You moved to the Big Island and had a plot of ag land, which you wanted to keep in ag, so you needed to get some animals. That's kind of how it started, yeah?
Exactly. That was the plan, to move to the Big Island as a retirement plan, and we kind of accelerated that when we found this piece of property and had investigated different options, and because we don't like to send our animals to slaughter, we found alpacas was a very good fit.
Well, how did you know about them in the first place?
A friend and I were visiting a cat show in Del Mar. Because I'd been in Hawaii for 20-odd years, I had never even seen alpacas before. And we were wandering around the fairgrounds looking for something to drink and stumbled across these funny-looking, long-necked animals. And went and took a look.
And they look like llamas, but smaller.
Right. They're pretty similar. They're actually related. Llamas are 350 pounds. Alpacas are 150 pounds.
Yeah, that makes them much more manageable. And they're also a lot nicer than llamas, I understand.
Well, they both get kind of a bad rap. Everybody says, do they spit? Well, they spit at each other when they're arguing over food, and that's usually the boys.
Uh-huh.
But in general, they're pretty peaceful animals.
So what's involved in raising them? How long does it take for them to grow up, for example?
Well, the kreas, which are the babies, they reach physical maturity when they're about age 2. So we start thinking about breeding at age 2. And they live for 15 to 20 years. Their pregnancy is a lot like a horse's in that they're pregnant for about 11 and a half months, but plus or minus 1 month. So we don't have due dates. We have due months.
And I'm also wondering how you got them to Hawaii in the first place.
We flew them on Pacific Airlift with Polo Ponies and Parker Ranch's new stud horse.
Uh-huh.
That's a real common way to bring livestock here out of the West Coast. And they do a great job in transporting. We've been on the plane with bulls, with sheep, with mules, and one time with a new telescope mirror for one of the observatories.
This is a whole other aspect of air travel most of us don't know much about, isn't it?
Yes, yes.
How many did you start with?
We started with four. I selected four animals in South Carolina and then brought them to my parents' farm in Ohio and kept them there for a while so that we could breed to some of the Ohio studs, and then brought them and a few more to our place here on the Big Island.
How many have you got now?
We have 12 now.
And purpose being their wool, which, what do you do, shear them like annually?
Exactly. So we shear them to get their fiber, which is our crop, if you will. And we take that fiber and we have it made into yarns. And we also use it in felting projects for example, felting hats. And then we sell our yarns and our finished product at the local farmers market.
And, you know, I'm wondering, in importing animals over that great distance and taking them very far from their country of origin, how was their adaptation to the climate, the soil, you know, just being in Hawaii generally?
Hawaii is actually a pretty good fit for them because we're up country. They do well on our grasses, which are lower protein. They do well in the rains. They actually come in out of the rain if it is raining very hard. They don't have many health issues at all. The only thing we had to work through was their nutritional needs for certain minerals, such as copper. And now that we have that worked out, they've been really easy keepers.
And you have a background as a vet, right?
Correct. Correct. I'm a small animal veterinarian.
So I'm assuming that was a great help in getting all this going.
That was a big help, and I also got my bachelor's in genetics, which ended up being a very good asset.
It does. It does sound that way. This is spreading throughout the country, isn't it?
It is. We are actually one of, I believe, all 50 states having significant herds of alpaca. They are also very common in Australia and New Zealand, and China is now importing significant herds for their own fiber industry.
This is kind of a view of the future, Jenny. Thanks very much for taking the time.
Oh, you're welcome. It was great to talk to you, Chris.
My pleasure. Jenny Brundage raises alpaca on her five-acre farm in Ahualoa on Hawaii Island, and you can learn more on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page. I'm glad to see that the whole approach to addiction has been really, we've moved around to understanding its physiological nature, yeah?
Well, as we heard Alan Johnson talk about a little earlier this half hour, some of that science has been around for 20 years. But
yeah,
how you change mindsets to accept that when people want to say, well, this is because someone doesn't have willpower, or they're just, you know, a moral failure, or, and not really linking it back to what we've learned about the brain and what addiction does to the brain and how the brain then functions after addiction and how much plasticity is really there to be able to bring about recovery, if that recovery can happen in a long and integrated way.
We're now in an age where scientific conclusions aren't necessarily trusted.
Well, I mean, we're going to see how true that continues to be. There's, you know, certain things that people have looked at with a fisheye for a while, but it, as it persists, as more empirical evidence comes out, it gets to be tougher to deny.
Well, let's hope so.
We'll see what happens with this, but certainly it looks like it's going to be a real shift in the way people with addiction and how prevention of addiction goes forward from this point on. We hope so, at least. That's going to do it for us for this hour of The Conversation. Coming up tomorrow, we're going to find out what do Hawaii and Alaska Native Tourism have in common. We'll be talking with Pohai Ryan. She's the Executive Director of the Native Hawaiian Hospitality Association, and she's back from attending her very first American Indian Alaska Native Tourism Association meeting.
And a Hawaii Island magic camp, and a look at today's youth in the Islamic world. We'd like to hear from you. You can reach us through our talkback line, 808-792-8217. You can email us, talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. Comments can be posted on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation, and Twitter messages at HI Conversation are BKOZHPR.
And if you want to hear this show again, get another show, a part of it, that's all on our Hawaii Conversation archive, which you can find on hawaiipublicradio.org.
I'm Chris Vanderkam.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. See you in the morning with more of The Conversation.